Past time, isn't it? Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Okay, you remember last time we talked about antithesis and the contrast between the two views we've been talking about, and we read from Genesis chapter 1, AJ did. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That's clear enough. And then we read this statement by Carl Sagan, that cosmos is all there is, all there was, and all there will ever be. So he said. Well, that's what we're going to looking at this morning. And before we get into that, however, I want you to read a statement here that from Philip Johnson, I think that's excellent. Because in our universal experience, unintelligent material processes do not create life. Christian theists know that Romans 1:20 is also true. Ever since the creation of the world, God's eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and are seen through the things he has made. In other words, there is absolutely no mystery about why living organisms appear to be the product of intelligent creation, and why scientific naturalists have to work so hard to keep themselves from perceiving the obvious. The reason living things give the appearance is that they actually are what they appear to be, and this fact is evident to all who do not cloud their minds with naturalistic philosophy or some comparable drug. Naturalistic philosophy, now we'll be looking at that here this morning. And then this further statement. The rest of the passage is also true. So they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal human beings or birds or four-footed animals or reptiles. What these words plainly mean is that those who turn away from God and toward naturalistic philosophy give up their minds, and in the process, and end up endorsing sophisticated nonsense and nature worship. That's from Philip Johnson's book, Reason in the Balance. Philip Johnson is a professor at UCLA in California and is an ardent anti-naturalist, obviously, and evolutionist. And there are several books by him. You'd like to look into them. I'll be glad to talk to you about them, to read them, though they're very good. Okay, well, what we want to do this morning is talk to you about the shift in the Weltanschauung that occurred in this country after 1860. You remember what the word Weltanschauung means now? It's a comprehensive conception of the world from a specific viewpoint. And that specific viewpoint, that comprehensive view, determines how you interpret the facts. All men interpret facts. There's no such thing as neutral facts. They're all interpreted. And men interpret the facts on the basis of their Weltanschauung. Prior to America, prior to the 1860s, in this country, the Weltanschauung was dominated by supernatural Christianity. And I want to read you a statement here by Erich Kuhnelt von Leiden, an Austrian philosopher and what have you. He said, if we call the American statesmen of the late 18th century the founding fathers of the United States, then the Pilgrims and Puritans were the grandfathers, and Calvin the great-grandfather. Though the fashionable 18th century deism may have persuaded some intellectual circles, may have pervaded some intellectual circles, the prevailing spirit of Americans before and after the War of Independence was essentially Calvinistic. And then, further confirmation that in the 1830s, 1820s, Alex de Tocqueville came over here and visited the country from France, and he went back and he wrote a book called Democracy in America. And he made the observation in there, he said that one of the interesting things about America is that Americans have almost no contact with government of any kind, county, state, or federal. He said, you know, the reason I looked into that and I thought, why is that? And he said, it's because they govern themselves. By what standard? He said, they're basically Calvinistic and they go with the Ten Commandments. And that was in the 1820s and 30s. And if people did that, of course, then you wouldn't have much need for the government or the police. Cohen, who's an American historian, written a book in which he says that the American, particularly the South, he said from the 1830s on, had the stamp of Geneva all over it, and they were haunted by God because they so lived under a dominant Christian Weltanschauung. So I don't think anybody would argue that before the 1860s, the dominant theory in this country was basically Orthodox Christianity, and fundamentally an Orthodox Christianity that expressed itself in Calvinism. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't some changes already beginning to take place. Old Henry Ware had been made the president of Harvard in 1805. Henry Ware was a Unitarian. Harvard was on his way out the window. It had gone. And it's going to get a lot worse if you go to look here and see and go to Harvard today. Well, we'll not say more about that. Okay. After 1860, there was a shift that began taking place. And the Weltanschauung became naturalism, fundamentally, as expressed through the evolutionary theory. Now, you remember what naturalism is. That was the view that says that the universe is self-operating, it's self-directing, and it's self-explanatory. You don't need to go anywhere else to find out how the universe got here and what it's doing here and how it's directed. Just look at nature. It'll tell you that. And so a naturalist says there is no supernatural. They get rid of that. And, of course, they viewed Calvinism and biblical orthodoxy as absolute heresy. Now, that naturalism, we'll jump the gun here a little bit, found its expression in uniformitarianism. That was a view that came out of the early 19th century, basically expressed by Charles Lyell in a book called The Principles of Geology in 1830-31. That's the book old Darwin was reading when he was on that trip around the world, that good little ship, he called it. And in that book, Sir Charles Lyell argued, as James Hutton had, is that the present is the key to the past. And therefore, everything that goes on in nature has been uniform. Only rarely could you ever talk about a catastrophe. So you go out to the Grand Canyon and you stand on the canyon, look, and they got a sign up there. Well, they used to, I don't know what it says now. But it said the Grand Canyon was 100 million years old. Now you ask the range park ranger, who told you that? Were you there? Oh, well, no. He said, what we know is that the present rate of evaporation, erosion, rate of erosion and wind erosion through the canyon and water erosion, what have you, at the present rate, it would take about 100 million years approximately for it to be this deep. So that's how we know. The present is the key to the past. Anybody been to Carlsbad Caravan in the last few years? The time I was there, it was years ago, back in 1957, I guess. I had a sign up there that Carlsbad Caravan is 240 million years old. Now, a few years later, they said, they took the sign down and said, it's 60 million. Then it came down again and said, it's 40 million. Now, I don't know if there's a sign there anymore. But what happened is they got in there, and the stalagmites and the stalagmites, which were supposed to be the determining factors as to how old it was, there's a problem here. They dug a tunnel in London some years ago to build a subway. And then they didn't put the subway in for years and years. Went back in there 30 years later, and there were stalagmites and stalagmites. So 30 years ago, 30 years is hardly 80 million. Or 40. So in Carlsbad, they took the sign down and said, we don't know. I think that's a good expression. But that's where they get it. Now, if you're a uniformitarian geologist, and that's what they get in geology all the time now, then you're going to take a naturalistic worldwide view. And then the view of evolution from simplicity to complexity. Old Darwin went around the world, in the 1831, 36. Came back and published his book in 1859, Origin of the Species. And in that book, he argued that this present order is a product of evolutionary development. It started off one cell existence from simplicity to increasing complexity. And it started off an increase in the enormous randomness, chaos, and confusion. And out of that has come gradually over time a lot of order. Now, who told you that, Darwin? Well, he said that that's what he observed. No, you didn't observe that. And he would admit it. Well, Sir Charles Lyell and his book has demonstrated that the present is the key to the past. And so if that's true, well then, that's a good way as well to interpret the beginning of life and what have you. So everything began this simplicity and complexity. And then along came the higher critics in the period after the war. Now, really, the higher critics started around 1753, but they got to be a dominant figure beginning about 1860s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And the critics said they were concerned for the reliability, the accuracy, and the date of ancient manuscripts. And what are the most numerous ancient manuscripts? It's biblical. It's amazing. And so they said, well, we're going to try to find out if Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Ruth and Esther and what have you were original, and if they're reliable, if they're accurate, and et cetera. No problem with that, except one. These guys, Eichhorn, Schleiermacher, Groff and Wielhausen, and all the rest of them you can list, all came to that question from a naturalistic set of assumptions. The universe is self-operating, self-explanatory, and self-developing. Now, if that's the case, then Genesis 1 creates a problem. As a matter of fact, the whole Pentateuch creates a problem. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Because they said, well, there are things written in there that people in couldn't have known about years ago like that. And so Moses, well, he wasn't the author. There's a bunch of authors, and they all wrote at different periods of times. And over the years, a redactor came along and took all those different writers and put them together and called it the Pentateuch and said it was the Bible. But that's not true. They said that's not true at all. So they came to the scriptures with a set of interpretations that said the Bible couldn't be what it says it is. And you certainly couldn't accept it at face value, because the scriptures are full of supernaturalism. A classic example. Go home and read Daniel chapter 8. Just read it this afternoon. And you'll be amazed. And these guys were not only amazed, they said Daniel could not have written that. He couldn't have written that because Daniel lived 250 or more years before that happened. It's too specific. He talks about the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire that came into existence and dominated the world of the Middle East, we call it. And then he talks about a ram that came out of the West and destroyed both Persia and Media and came to be dominant. And then that realm dies, and his kingdom is divided into four different kingdoms. And then he goes on to tell them what their names are. These guys said, that couldn't be Daniel writing. You see why it couldn't be? If you're a naturalist. If you're a naturalist, it couldn't be Daniel wrote it, because if he did, then it blows the whole naturalist scheme out of the water. It's over, fellows. That means God is in control of history. And that he rules and dominates the universe, he directs it, he operates it, and he explains it. So Daniel didn't write that. That was written by somebody that lived a long time after Daniel, just stuck his name on it so he'd get a reading. Okay, well, now what we want to do here this morning is try to look at three or four disciplines, and we're going to do that rather rapidly, to show you how naturalism came to affect these disciplines in America. And came to affect them in the sense that these guys in these disciplines began trying to interpret them from the naturalistic world and life view. And just to give you a classic example, old Henry Ward Beecher. Henry Ward Beecher was a minister in New York City for years, in the 1850s and 60s and 70s, and was a very popular preacher. He was a good orator, very skilled, orating man. After Darwin's book came out, Beecher read it, and he said, "I have changed my mind. I've got to abandon," he said, "these following biblical doctrines: original sin, fall of man, predestination and election, redemption from sin, regeneration." He said, "I can't hold that any longer." Why couldn't you? Well, he'd become a naturalist. And a naturalist can't hold of that, because this is a naturalist humbug. And then he was followed by a guy named Lyman Abbott. Lyman Abbott was his cohort. Abbott came along and said, "Well, we're going to have to advocate a new theology. It's called progressive orthodoxy." And this is what he said: "The Bible and Revelation, the Bible is a record of man's moral and spiritual growth. And Revelation is just the gradual and progressive unveiling in human consciousness of the divine truth. It's not a revelation from God himself." Oh, no, no, God didn't. God is not involved in the universe. What about sin? Sin is just a relapse into a lower stage of spiritual development. That's all it is. And Christ was the infinite entering into human life in order to evolve the latent divinity that are in all of us. So did you know that you had a latent divinity in you? And that Christ came to evolve that latent divinity in you and develop it? That's not Christianity at all. And Washington Gladden came along, wrote a book, Who Wrote the Bible, 1891, and then he said in the introduction, "The Bible is not infallible, historically, morally, or scientifically." Now, if you went off to seminary and sat under this kind of guy, you had a choice, an antithesis. You could swallow that, and he swallowed it on the basis of what? He was a naturalist. He said the universe is self-operating, self-explanatory, and self-defining. There is no involvement of God in it at all. And so, therefore, can you trust the Bible? He said, "Well, of course not. The Bible has no validity to it whatsoever." And then we talked about the rise of the higher critics, and we don't need to spend any more time with those fellows. And that's what they were concerned with, basically, right there. The true and reliable text, and the higher critics want to know all these varying things here. And there's not a thing we'll want to know any of that. That's fine. No objection to that. It's just that you come to answer these questions from a naturalistic set of assumptions, then you're going to have to interpret the facts differently. Like Daniel 8, or Isaiah 53, or Isaiah 40, I believe it's chapter 40, where Isaiah, God said, "I'm going to raise up Cyrus, my servant," so-and-so. Now they came along and said, "Well, now, wait a minute. Isaiah lived 150 years before Cyrus was even born. He couldn't have known anything about Cyrus." So Isaiah didn't write that. Matter of fact, Isaiah was divided into five parts by some of them said two parts, but anyway, but it certainly wasn't Isaiah, because if it was, well, it's all over. That means God's in control of history. So, you see, when they came to the facts, they didn't come unbiased. You remember that statement by Van Riesen? The very idea of an unprejudiced investigation of the facts, resulting in their so-called objective description, is an instance of self-deception. What Van Riesen was saying is, nobody comes to the facts unprejudiced. We all do. Come out with it, admit it, and go on. And Van Riesen was a supernaturalist, and he said, "I don't have the slightest hesitation in admitting that, and therefore the Bible is truth, it's the Word of God, and Cyrus was born, as it said, and Isaiah wrote it, no problem." But now the naturalist says, "Well, I can't accept that, because if I do, then naturalism goes out the window." Okay, well, so you see, the discipline of theology was increasingly coming under a naturalistic set of assumptions, and what was happening is, if you're going off to Union University, or Union Seminary in New York City, by the late 70s. In the 80s, no, that's what you were being fed. And it came to be increasingly so at the University of Chicago, Theological Seminary, and Rochester, and varying other places all across the North. And it began creeping into the South and would have at Southern Seminary, where they hired old Crawford Toy, T-O-Y. Brilliant fellow. He was. And he came with all his credentials. And they hired him. And he hadn't been there long until they started saying, "We smell a rat." And they did. And finally brought us, and Boyce, who was president of the seminary, dismissed him. Although he said, "I love the man." But he said, "You cannot. We are not going to permit that teaching here." What Toy was doing, he was beginning to say, the Bible, well, it's not a revelation of the mind of God. And he just got drifting further and further into this evolutionary naturalism. So they dismissed him. And he left there and went to the Northeast and joined one of the seminaries there, taught at Harvard, or I believe at Harvard for a while, finally became a Unitarian. Then he finally became a Universalist. Then he just quit. He got consistent. If you were an evolutionary naturalist, the whole business of worrying about supernaturalism or the world to come, foolishness. You're wasting your time. But they got rid of Toy, and fortunately, they got rid of him. Unfortunately, it didn't stop there. School kept drifting, and then Boyce died in 1888. Broadus died in the late 1890s, if I remember. And by that time, you were getting into a drift, which, as one professor said, who is now at Southern Seminary, said what was going on among Southern Baptists was that increasingly from the 1890s on, they quit doctrinal preaching, and it got increasingly sentimental. And they quit disciplining members of the church because it began running into problem. You had too many people that it shouldn't have been in the church. I read a figure this past week about that. 1870, there were among Southern Baptists in the South, that included all the South from Maryland all the way to Texas and what have you. There were 1,100,000 members of Southern Baptist churches. And then it said 5,500,000 attendees, which meant that most people who were going to church were not members, because in those days, you know, if you wanted to join the church, they didn't open the door and say, "Come on down and join us." If you'd gone down and said, "I'd like to join," they'd have said, "Why? Why do you want to join?" And then you had to give a credible profession of faith before the elders, pastors, and what have you, the deacons. And then they would take you into the church, but then there was a clear understanding was, if you come in now, you understand their responsibilities and obligations. Failure to meet those, you'll be dismissed. Now, that they began to drop by the 1890s and into the 1900s because, again, you see, they were drifting increasingly away from biblical Christianity. Well, evolutionary naturalism infected all the disciplines in the country, and we're going to just look at some of them here. Sociology. You know what sociology is? It's a study of modern human group behavior. I guess it has some validity to it. No. I had a friend who went to, I believe, Mississippi State. He got his PhD in sociology. And he did all the work, did the final exams, what have you, went through his orals, what have you, and he got through, they wouldn't confer it on him. And he said, "Why?" "Well, you don't really believe in sociology." He said, "Well, I believe in biblical sociology, no problem. About modern human group behavior." They said, "Well, we couldn't give you that degree." He went to a lawyer and told him the story, and the lawyer said, "Let us hope they don't give it to you. You'll wind up richer than you'll ever be teaching it." It was an interesting story. Anyway, the lawyer wrote the president of the school, the university, a letter, explained what was going on. Now, the president didn't know about it. The president calls in the head of the sociology department, "What's going on?" And the guy explained it to him. The president said, did he do all the work? Yes, he did. Did he pass the oral? He did. Did he do his dissertation? He did. He said, fellas, if you didn't want him to have the degree, you should have stopped him a long time before that. We're going to give him the degree. And if you don't, I, as the president, will give it to him. Because if we don't, he said, he'll wind up costing us $3 to $5 million. Oh, well. So they conferred on him his PhD. But now you see how consistent they are. They were being consistent. Of course, so was Edsel. Edsel said most of what they teach in sociology is humbug. Bunk, box, bull, and baloney, he said, with a heavy emphasis on the latter. You can see why they didn't want him having a degree. They don't. You go off to another university and teach, and you're going to say it. He said, that's exactly right. Well, anyway, what did the evolutionists say? Well, Herbert Spencer was a good example. He taught the principle of the survival of the fittest is to be applied to all society. And in society, there's a law of progress. He said, progress is not an accident. It's a necessity. What we are calling evil and immorality must disappear. It is certain that man must become perfect. Now, he was serious. You see, the problem of man is not sin. The problem of man is lack of education, lack of proper environment. And if we just alter those things, then we'll progress to a perfect order. Now, that view had already been started by Horace Mann. You remember who was the champion of the public school system back there in the 1830s? When he argued if we get the public school system started and the state set up, and the state makes everybody go, and then the state approves the teachers. Then we can so instruct the children and men is that by the turn end of the 20th century, he said, crime and war and poverty would have disappeared. He missed it a little bit. Just a little. We're going to see one of them here later going to say something about by the year 2000. Oh, it's such absurdity. Oh, yeah, you missed it worse. Then there's William Graham Sumner, a professor at Yale, who said, man is not a special creation of God, but is an animal brought forth by natural evolution. The difference between man and animals is a matter of degree, not of kind. You're just a higher animal. There's no difference between you and a dog or an ape, except you're just a higher form of animal. Now, as a result of that, he said, there's no such thing as natural rights, God-given rights. There's no such thing as that. There are only civil rights, and these rights are developed by men out of historical experience. Man has no more right to life, he said, than a rattlesnake. So if you are in a culture that has developed far enough, then it may have rules against murder and what have you, but that's all they are. It's not because you have a right to life. You don't have it. Now you see why this view, which had such an influence in Germany, during this period, by the time the Nazis came to power, they were consistent. Progress is development, and progress is made, so argued Nietzsche and the others, by the superior men gaining control of the evolutionary process and getting rid of the herd. And in so doing, will create a perfectible order and a higher order. But men don't have any right to life. So is anything wrong with killing a Jew? Of course not. A Jew is inferior. Or a gypsy. Obviously, gypsies are inferior. Get rid of them. They are hindrance to the progress of the race. The Slavs, like the Ukrainians when the Germans overran, you know, Russia and the Ukraine, Ukrainians welcomed them. Welcomed them with flags and shouting, yeah, we'll be glad you're here. The Germans didn't have enough sense to recognize it. They said, no, you people are inferior. So they started suppressing them. On what grounds? We're trying to create a new order. And we've got to get rid of this inferior class. Sumner was an advocate of ethical relativism. He said, customs, traditions, laws, institutions, morals possess no universal validity whatsoever. Well, get together. And there's Mr. Frank Ward, published a book in 1883, which greatly influenced, by the way, Woodrow Wilson. dynamic sociology, and that's what Ward said there. You can read that. He rejected Orthodox Christianity for the religion of humanity. He said the universe is not a personal, self-conscious product of God, but rather it is simply matter and energy pulsating, breathing, as it were. God had nothing whatsoever to do with it. There is no God to be involved in that process or whatever. It's a pulsative creating energy. All things are but different manifestation of this basal energy. If you want to read, that's enough of that to illustrate the point there. The instruments for directing society was a beneficent state under the control of legislators who must social engineer and the sociologists. This kind of mentality is going to produce the progressives. You keep hearing Hillary said she gets to power. She's going to try to fulfill the progressive goals. That's where this stuff got started. And if Russ will permit me, next Sunday, we're going to talk about the progressives, what they were and what they espoused. And you're going to see it is stamped all over these politicians in our day, and maybe to some degree over you. Okay, Edward Bellamy, another sociologist, came out and published a book called Looking Backwards. Sold an enormous amount of copies. And that's what he espoused, plus a bunch of other stuff. He said there will be a utopia in America by 2000 A.D. War, crime, poverty, and all those things are a thing of the past. They'll be gone. Remember when Woodrow Wilson went off to World War I? What did he say? Why are we going into that war? He said, we're going to war because this is the war that's going to end all wars. Wilson swallowed that nonsense. Now, it didn't exactly happen. Matter of fact, it got worse. But what's unusual about this crowd? What Reagan said about the government, the worst thing a man can hear, somebody show up at the door and say, we're from the government, we're here to help you. Okay. The instruments to bring all this about is the central state. The state governments are going to disappear. We need to get rid of the state government in Little Rock and in Austin and all these state capitals and divide the country into regions. You know there's been a movement about trying to do that in the northeast, the southeast, the west, the midwest, et cetera, and make state capitals basically irrelevant because they are a hindrance to progress, so says this crowd. The central state will abolish competition and it will eliminate waste, and he has some other rules. The state is going to decree that all people go to school up until they're 21, and then from 21 to 45, they go into the workforce. You don't get a choice about that, and you get assigned to the workforce where you are needed, and at 45, you are forced into retirement, and the state will take care of you all through that period. Like a world I wouldn't want to live in. It's not like a totalitarian world, which, of course, is what it is. Okay, well, enough of the sociologists. Then came along this crowd here, the psychologists. I'm going to say a little bit about them. Psychology is the study of the individual, his mind, and what have you, his processes. And we're just going to look at two guys. Sigmund Freud, 1856 to 1939. He began his approach as an explanation of man's mind from an anthropological base. His reasoning for doing so was a simple one. He was an evolutionary naturalistic scientist, and he recognized that the doctrine of biological evolution was fundamental to his perspective. Now, we're just going to look at a central concept of Freud. What was Freud's primary concern about man? Well, he said man's basic problem is not sin. No. Man's basic problem is that he has a feeling of guilt. All men feel guilty. Freud said, I feel guilty. And he admitted it and told me, I hadn't been able to get rid of it. But he said, I know why it's there. So, you feel guilty? Well, Freud said, of course you do. Everybody does. Now, what caused that? He said, well, that's because there are three major systems that influence the personality. First, there's the id. That the oldest aspects of man's personality contains everything that is inherited and fixed in man's nature. It is totally amoral. Its demands are only pleasure and self-gratification. So the id is your old basic animal nature. All its drives and its desires. And it has no moral base at all. It's amoral. Then there's the ego. That's another part of man. The ego is the center of man, the I. It mediates between his senses and his needs. It is the synthesizer between the conflicting impulses and the external rules of the culture. And the culture is created by the superego. Consists of the rules, customs, laws, etc., brought to the man by parents, church, school, society, etc. It makes the ego depend upon the external world and exercises a steady pressure for conformity. So why do you feel guilty? Well, you got these animal drives. It's it. And then you got this culture back here, this superego, which got all these rules. And get caught in the middle is the ego. Drive says, I want this. Rule says, don't do that. You shouldn't do that. It's not right. It's wrong. So that's why you feel guilty. You're violating the rules of the superego. Now, are you really guilty then? Paul said, well, of course not. There's no such thing as guilt. But now, he said, though I know there's no such thing as guilt, I can't get rid of it myself from that feeling. So is man really guilty according to this? Freud said, that'd be far enough to read that. Is man really guilty under Freud's anthropological approach? No. What Freud said there. He said, I don't fear or have any awe whatever of the Almighty. None whatever. Matter of fact, he got the arrogance to say, if I were ever to meet him, I would have more reproaches to make of him than he could make about me. You talk about the comment of a fool. As a classic example of a man who was consistent in his naturalism. If naturalism is true, then there's no God and no morals. All that stuff goes out the window. So I got to explain why men feel guilty. Well, it has to be a naturalistic reason. And that's it. Conflict between your animal drives and your culture, and you get caught in the middle and you have to make these decisions. So he said, I can't get rid of it altogether. But I can help you out. Maybe if you come to recognize it, you can live with it without too much trouble, feeling guilty. So you're going to feel guilty because you're going to be continually violating the rules of the superego. But Freud said, don't worry about that. If you can convince yourself that that's true, then you won't have much problem about it. And then there's Carl Rogers. Any of you here remember the Bob Newhart show? So Bob Newhart played that psychologist in Chicago. You remember that show? It was a comedy of sort. But the whole thrust of the thing, old Newhart, he was a follower of Carl Rogers. Because you remember in the movie, in the show, Newhart never told anybody what to do. That's what Roger said. Roger said, we don't have a right to tell men what to do because there's no such thing as the right rules. Because there is no truth ultimately like that. So when a man comes in and he has a problem, what the counselor, like Roger and counselor would do was say, let us sit down and tell me about it. And the man would tell him how he was feeling. And the counselor would say, well, what do you think about that? And what do you think you ought to do about that? The counselor would never say, Harold, what you're doing, no wonder you feel like that. You're wrong. You're a thief. Put the money back and stop stealing. Oh, no. You wouldn't tell him that. You have no right to impose upon him your moral values. Because moral values have no validity anyway. (Clears throat) to me, that whole position is so absurd that it's hard to talk about it with anything except some degree of, I guess you'd call it, humor. But that's the approach. And there are a lot of Rogerian counselors out there, and that's what you'll get if you go to them. They're not going to tell you what to do or not to do because they're going to say, I have no right to impose upon you the rules because there are no really rules. So self-direct yourself. Let's see if I've got that. Find it. No, I don't think I brought that with me. Forget it. Well, this would go to something else, but Edward Gibbons, the direction of the judge of the first engine tyranny. I didn't get involved here in the law profession much. We're just going to very briefly say something about that. Following the war between the states, the legal profession came under the spell of naturalism. The first clear example of that was they appointed old Christopher Langdale, dean of the law school at Harvard in 1870. And Langdale made it very clear, we're going to have to get rid of all these biblical notions about what's right and wrong. What's the duty of the person, the duty of the citizen, the duty of the state? We're going to have to chunk all of that. And this is the reason we're going to have to do that. There is no transcendent personal God. And if there is no transcendent personal God, then there can't be any rules imposed upon man from outside of him and outside of the culture. So we're on our own. Both the world and man result from evolutionary forces which continue to direct them. Societal institutions such as the family and civil law have no theistic origins. Genesis chapter 2 and 3, nonsensical. Theistically ordained absolute standards do not exist for the guidance of either individuals or institutions. I said, the Bible is false and useless as a source of guidance for men in his attempt to progress. Man's self-effort is the primary, if not sole, tool available to him in his quest for progress. Now, what Langdale said is, these are the principles that need to dominate the law schools. We need to recognize that these things are all basically false. Let me show you something right here. Theistically ordained absolute standards do not exist for the guidance of either individuals or institutions. Oh, is that right? Well, then what does? It's that kind of mentality that led to the problem at Nuremberg. You remember what Churchill said about Nuremberg? When we tried all those Nazis for those war crimes? When they got through, Churchill said, I think about all that happened in Nuremberg is that the winners shot the losers. We didn't seem to know why what they did was wrong. And, of course, they didn't. You adopt that viewpoint, which all those guys did who came out of these law schools. Then what's wrong with killing Jews, Gypsies, Slavs, political deviants? What's wrong with that? You tell me under this principle. And that's why Churchill said, we didn't seem to know what they did was wrong because they didn't know. You adopt that principle, then you can't tell me why we shouldn't practice abortion, for example. Why not kill the child before it's born? If he's inconvenient. And we've done more than the Nazis ever thought about doing in terms of killing people. They killed maybe 15 million or so. We've killed, 55 million in the womb, something like that, already? And we have the audacity to go around saying, we don't like what Stalin did and Hitler did. We owe them an apology, probably. Right. Now, they're brutal men. But they were brutal men consistently. They would have said there's no such thing as brutal men. Again, that's a biblical world and life view. We've chunked that. We're now naturalists. And under naturalism, there's no such things as rules like that. Now, if you adopt that kind of view, then you're going to wind up with an entirely different legal system and basically wind up saying whatever the court rule is what's right and what's wrong. And, of course, as time develops, we're in the process of evolutionary change, and you can never be sure tomorrow what might develop and what they might decide about you and about me, because you don't have any right to life according to that view. Okay, well, we're going to look at this and then we're going to quit here. That's simply a contrast between the change. That's the pre-1860 old Weltanschauung, its basic principles. And that's what they had become increasingly after 1860. And you can see there is an antithesis. There's a conflict there, a contrast. They are not alike. And so I don't have any common grounds when I sit down with a naturalist to discuss some issue that we're going to agree. Now, we're going to agree that 2 plus 2 is 4. Now, he's got a problem there. I remember Greg Singer saying one time, he said, if you want to go and create a stir in a bunch of philosophers and mathematicians, he said, go to their national convention and get amongst them while they're in discussion of mathematics. He said, fellas, I'd like to ask a question. Well, you guys explain to me why 2 plus 2 is always 4. And he said, you watch them. Get into an agitated spin. Because they know what you're saying. How many times is it 4? Always. You mean it can't be 4 to 8 or 16? No. It's always 4. Why is 8 plus 8 always 16? Absolutely. You see, they don't like absolute principles and truth. Because we do. Whoop. That means there's a giver that established these laws. And so when you come to any discipline, I don't care what it is, mathematics, history, whatever else, you're going to be teaching it from one of these frameworks. You're going to think in these frameworks. And that's pre-1860. That's what they thought about it before the war. And increasingly after the war, it came to be this. And, of course, this is the view now that totally dominates the culture. God probably doesn't exist. Universe is a product of chance. There's no plan at all. All just chaos. Man's not significant. He's only a higher animal. No absolute truth. Man's not a sinner. He's not fallen. The problem is ignorance. And there's ultimately no way of escape. This bunch has what they have to offer is absolute hopelessness. Well, sociology, you go and sit in any sociology class, psychology class, this is the framework you're going to get. With a rare exception, my friend Edsel, for example, who would announce to his class at the beginning of his sociology classes. Now, you understand a great deal of what you're reading in that book is baloney. It's baloney. It's not true. And this is the framework from which I'm going to teach the class. Well, of course, he's right. Edsel Lusby. He was a professor over at Southern State until his death several years ago. You know, I knew him in Washtenaw when we were there together. Okay, well, any questions?
That's exactly what the naturalists just say. All that's in that word, in that Bible.
That's right. Oh, yeah, the Bible.
So they have an opposite world of life.
That's exactly right. Well, you can't believe the Bible and accept that view. They're not compatible.
And our job as Christians to constantly say yes.
Right, that's right.
We're on the other side.
Right. That's our responsibility is to confront them. Don't try to get along with him. Right. No, I'm not trying to get along with you. You're wrong. Right. What you're teaching is baloney. Right. You know, this idea you're going to create a world, heaven on earth. We're going to get rid of poverty and war. We're going to have war on poverty, Lyndon Johnson said. And it got worse. It's far worse than it was when he was president. But anyway, don't be surprised with that kind of stuff. But that's where he got it. Johnson was an evolutionary progressive. Right.
You mentioned Thomas Huxley.
Right.
He espoused all the things.
Right.
But his, I think his son or grandson, Otis Huxley, continued that in the UN.
Right. That's right. Nothing changed there. The UN was built on the progressive ideology that they could get together and talk about it and solve the problem of war. Well, hopefully next week we'll just talk about the progressives and then we'll let it go. Any questions? Any observations? That's what they would have said. Okay, let's stand and we'll be dismissed.